and the Angels Were Silent by Max Lucado. Chapter 16, Surviving Life. But those people who keep their faith until the end will be saved. The good news about God's kingdom will be preached in all the world to every nation. Then the end will come. Matthew 24, verses 13 and 14. Not all of you will understand this chapter. Not all of you will comprehend its message or relate to its promise. You won't understand it if you've never failed and are intolerant of those who have. Your life is as hygienic as a new hospital, and your soul could pass the white glove test. You are a red-hot zealot who thinks God is lucky to have you on his side. You dreamed of a perfect home and got it. You dreamed of the perfect job and got it. Dreamed of the problem-free life and got it. Your pillow has never known tears. Your prayers have never known anguish. And your faith has never known doubt. If you are tearless and fearless and can't understand why others aren't, then this chapter is going to sound like a foreign language. Why? Because this is a chapter on survival. The next few pages deal with coping with pain. The following paragraphs were not written for those on top of the world, but for those trapped under one which has collapsed. If you can relate to that description, then turn to Matthew and get ready for some assurance. That may surprise you if you know anything about Matthew 24. You remember it as the neighborhood hangout for end times fanatics, the camping ground for eschatological mathematicians and last day prophets. It deserves that reputation. This section, known as the Olivet Discourse, is Christ's proclamation of end times. Scholars have dedicated more than one book to this one chapter to answer one question. What is Jesus saying? Ominous phrases lurk in the chapter. Wars and rumors of wars, the destroying terror, and how terrible it will be for women who are pregnant. Eerie descriptions of the sun growing dark and the moon not giving its light. Vultures hovering around bodies and lightning flashing. How do we explain it? Some feel the entire chapter is symbolic and mustn't be interpreted literally. Others feel it is a combination of comments equally applied to the destruction of Jerusalem and the return of Christ. Still others state that the chapter has one purpose, and that is to prepare us for the final judgment. We know two things for sure. First, Jesus is preparing his disciples for a cataclysmic future. His words of disaster rang true in AD 70 when Jerusalem was brought to her knees by the Romans. His words will ring true again when he comes to reclaim his own and put a period after history. We also know, however, that cataclysms don't just occur in Jerusalem and at the end of history. Hungry bodies and cold hearts are easily found today. The counsel Jesus gives on surviving rough times is useful for more than the battles of Rome and Armageddon. It is useful for the battles of your world and mine. So if you are looking for my prediction of the day Christ will return, sorry, you won't find it here. He hasn't chosen to give us that date. So time spent speculating is time poorly used. He has chosen, however, to give a manual of survival for lives under siege. As Jesus left the temple and was walking away, his followers came up to show him the temple's buildings. Jesus asked, "Do you see all these buildings? I tell you the truth. Not one stone will be left on another. Every stone will be thrown down to the ground." It's impossible to overstate the role of the temple in the Jewish mind. The temple was the meeting place between God and man. It represented the atonement, the sacrifice, and the priesthood. It was the structure that represented the heart of the people. The temple was dazzling, built with white marble and plated with gold. In the sun it shone so brightly as to test the eyes. The temple area was surrounded by porches, and on these porches were pillars cut out of solid marble in one piece. They were 37.5 feet high and so thick that three men joining hands could barely encircle one. Archaeologists have found cornerstones from the temple which measure 20 to 40 feet in length and weigh more than 400 tons. What an impressive sight this must have been for the rural followers of Jesus. Little wonder they were slack-jawed. But more stirring than what they saw was what they heard Jesus say, "I tell you the truth, not one stone will be left on another. Every stone will be thrown down to the ground." There is pathos in the simple phrase which begins the chapter. He was walking away from it. Jesus has turned his back on the temple. The one who called for the construction of the temple is walking away from it. The Holy One has abandoned the cherished mountain. He told them, "The whole thing will come crashing down." To say the temple would crash was to say the nation would crash. The temple was the people. For over a millennium, the temple had been the heart of Israel, and now Jesus was saying the heart would break. "Your house will be left completely empty," he told the Pharisees earlier in the day. And crash it did. In AD 70, Titus, the Roman general, laid siege to the city. Being set on a hill, Jerusalem was difficult to take, so Titus resolved to starve it. The grim horror of the famine is a black day in Jewish history. Let the historian Josephus describe the siege. "Then did the famine widen in its progress and devoured people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying of famine, and the lanes of the city were full of dead bodies of the aged. The children also and young men wandered about the marketplaces like shadows, all swelled with famine and fell down dead, wheresoever their misery seized them. The famine confounded all natural passions, for those who were just going to die looked upon those who were gone to rest before them with dry eyes and open mouths. A deep silence also, and a kind of deadly night had seized upon the city, and every one of them died with their eyes fixed upon the temple." A holocaust. 97,000 were taken captive, and 1,000,000 were slain. It was this disaster that Jesus foresaw. It was for this disaster that he prepared his disciples. And it is this type of disaster that can strike your world. Some years ago, we took a family vacation to Santa Fe, New Mexico. Denilin and I decided to be adventurous and ride the rapids of the Rio Grande. We drove to the designated spot and there met the guide and the other courageous tourists. His instructions were foreboding. "When you fall in the water," he began, "and when you find yourself floating in the river, and when the boat flips over..." I was beginning to get nervous. I elbowed Denilin and whispered, "Notice he doesn't say, if." Nor did Jesus. Jesus didn't say, "In this world you may have trouble," or, "In this world there are some who have trouble." No, he assured us, "In this world you will have trouble. If you have a pulse, you will have pain. If you are a person, you will have problems." In Matthew 24, Jesus prepares his disciples by telling them what will happen. "Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will fool many people. You will hear about wars and stories of wars that are coming, but don't be afraid. These things must happen before the end comes. There will be times when there is no food for people to eat, and there will be earthquakes in different places. These things are like the first pains when something new is about to be born. Then people will arrest you, hand you over to be hurt, and kill you. They will hate you because you believe in me." Far from a pep rally, don't you think? more like a last word given by an officer before the soldiers go to battle. More like a lesson Charles Hall would give his demolition team. Charles Hall blows up bombs for a living. He is part of the EOD, the Explosive Ordnance Demolition. He is paid $1,500 a week to walk the sands of post-war Kuwait searching for live mines or discounted grenades. Richard Lowther, another EOD expert, has spent years blowing up some of the thousands of sea mines left over from World Wars I and II. He said, "Every time I pick up the paper and read about a new civil war, I think, great, as soon as it's over, I'll be there." You and I and these EODs have a lot in common. Treacherous trails through explosive territories. Problems which lay partly obscured by the sand. A constant threat of losing life or limb. And most significant, we, like the demolition team, are called to walk through a minefield which we didn't create. Such is the case with many of life's struggles. We didn't create them, but we have to live with them. We didn't make alcohol, but our highways have drunk drivers. We don't sell drugs, but our neighborhoods have those who do. We didn't create international tension, but we have to fear the terrorists. We didn't train the thieves, but each of us is a potential victim of their greed. We, like the EODs, are tiptoeing through a minefield which we didn't create. The disciples were about to do the same. The collapse of the temple wasn't their fault. They weren't to be blamed for the rejection of Christ. It wasn't because of them that Jesus said, "The house will be left completely empty," but because they lived in a sinful world, they would be victims of sin's consequences. If you live on a shooting range, chances are you're going to catch a bullet. If you live on a battlefield, a cannonball will likely land in your yard. If you walk through a dark room, you may stub your toe. If you walk through a minefield, you may lose your life. And if you live in a world darkened by sin, you may be its victim. Jesus is honest about the life we are called to lead. There is no guarantee that just because we belong to Him, we will go unscathed. No promise is found in Scripture that says, when you follow the King, you are exempt from battle. No, often just the opposite is the case. How do we survive the battle? How do we endure the fray? Jesus gives three certainties, three assurances, three absolutes. Imagine Him leaning closer and looking deeply into the eyes of the disciples. Knowing the jungle they are about to enter, He gives them three compasses which, if used, will keep them on the right trail. First, assurance of victory. Those people who keep their faith until the end will be saved. He doesn't say, if you succeed, you will be saved, or if you come out on top, you will be saved. He says, if you endure. An accurate rendering would be, if you hang in there until the end, if you go the distance. The Brazilians have a great phrase for this. In Portuguese, a person who has the ability to hang in and not give up has garra. Garra means claws. What imagery! A person with garra has claws which burrow into the side of the cliff and keep him from falling. So do the saved. They may get close to the edge. They may stumble and slide. But they will dig their nails into the rock of God and hang on. Jesus gives you this assurance. If you hang on, He'll make sure you get home. Secondly, Jesus gives the assurance of accomplishment. The good news about God's kingdom will be preached in all the world to every nation. In 1066, one of the most decisive battles in the history of the world was fought. William, Duke of Normandy, dared to invade England. The English were a formidable opponent anywhere, but next to invincible in their own land. But William had something the English did not. He had invented a device which gave his army a heavy advantage in battle. He had an edge, the stirrup. Conventional wisdom of the day was that a horse was too unstable a platform from which to fight. As a result, soldiers would ride their horses to the battlefield and then dismount before engaging in combat. But the Norman army, standing secure in their stirrups, were able to ride down the English. They were faster and they were stronger. The stirrup led to the conquest of England. Without it, William might never have challenged such an army, and this book might have been written in Old English. Because they had a way to stand in the battle, they were victorious after the battle. Jesus' assurance of victory was daring. Look at his listeners, upcountry fishermen and laborers whose eyes bug at the sight of a big city. You'd have been hard-pressed to find anyone who would wager that the prophecy would come to pass. But it did. Just 53 days later. 53 days later, Jews were in Jerusalem from every country in the world. Peter stood before them and told them about Jesus. The disciples were emboldened with the assurance that the task would be completed. Because they had a way to stand in the battle, they were victorious after the battle. They had an edge. And so do we. Lastly, Jesus gives us assurance of completion. Then the end will come. An intriguing verse is found in 1 Thessalonians 4:16. The Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command. Have you ever wondered what that command will be? It will be the inaugural word of heaven. It will be the first audible message most of us have heard from God. It will be the word which closes one age and opens a new one. I think I know what the command will be. I could very well be wrong, but I think the command which puts an end to the pains of the earth and initiates the joys of heaven will be two words. No more. The King of Kings will raise his pierced hand and proclaim, no more. The angels will stand and the Father will speak, no more. Every person who lives and whoever lived will turn around to the sky and hear God announce, no more. No more loneliness. No more tears. No more death. No more sadness. No more crying. No more pain. As John sat on the island of Patmos, surrounded by sea and separated from friends, he dreamed of the day when God would say, no more. This same disciple who, over half a century before, had heard Jesus speak these words of assurance now knew what they meant. I wonder if he could hear the voice of Jesus in his memory. The end will come. For those who live for this world, that's bad news. But for those who live for the world to come, it's an encouraging promise. You're in a minefield, my friend, and it's only a matter of time. For in this world you will have trouble. Next time you are tossed into a river, as you ride the rapids of life, remember his words of assurance. Those who endure will be saved. The gospel will be preached. The end will come. You can count on it.